The following is a recording of Peter Aumann presenting U.S. and German Relations post-1989, October 25th, 2019.
Another large group today, and we expect to be a very interesting presentation and maybe some interesting questions based on what's going on in the world. Before I go further, I want to correct something from last session. If you remember, I introduced a number of guests and I told you who I wasn't. I didn't tell people who I am. For those of you who haven't met me, my name is John Gilbert. I've been on the local World Affairs Council board for a couple of years and was recently asked to become president for the coming year. That's who I am. And I want to thank the two people who provided feedback that I should have said who I was. Just a couple of announcements today. One of the things is, in addition to these Friday sessions, we also organize and present a number of other events for members and some for the general public. One of these is the evening speaker series, which is not the same as a different speaker series that's being advertised here on Hilton Head Island. The evening speaker series is going to be held starting in January. We already have a full speaker lineup. The first speaker is Bing West, who's a part-time local resident, and he co-authored General Jim Mattis's recent book. So he'll be there. People who want to subscribe to the series, it's $80 for the four events. That includes some food, the talk itself, and an opportunity to buy drinks at the bar. But if you can't make all of them and want to attend just one or two, it's $25 a person. Starting in early November, we'll open that up for formal registration. And it's going to be presented at the Soundwaves facility near Coligny Circle. It's the new facility there that the symphony actually owns, but they made it available for us for those four nights. Now, having said all that, I'd like to introduce Margaret McManus, who's our vice president and is acting as hostess and introducer for today's speaker. Margaret?
Good morning. Good morning. 30 years have passed since the days of German reunification. But the generation who lived through the Cold Year wars and those who experienced what was going on at the time in the world is slowly slipping away. The world is changing. The UK leaving the European Union, the advancement of populist political movements throughout Europe, and opportunistic Russia filling the space left by the withdrawal of the West, and an increasingly authoritarian China pursuing its long-term plan of taking the lead position in the world. With all this change going on, we are lucky this morning to have Ambassador Peter Aumann here to tell us about another change, the changing relationship between Germany and the United States over the past 30 years. Today, both the German and the U.S. societies are internally divided by new fault lines, some cultural, some economic, some political in nature. The vision of a transatlantic free trade and investment partnership is dead. In the foreign policy debates, short-term gains trump long-term strategic thinking, thus producing the dangerous narratives of neglected self-interest on both sides. The U.S.-German relationship is in crisis and needs fresh thinking. Ambassador Aumann is well-suited to address this topic, having served most recently as German ambassador to the United Kingdom. He was ambassador to the United States in 2011 through 2014, And earlier in his career, he was ambassador to France. Additionally, he has served as the German Deputy Foreign Secretary at the German Foreign Office in Berlin. A staunch advocate of free trade, Amon has worked as Director General for Economics at the German Foreign Office earlier in his career, where he helped German companies build a global presence. Also, from 2001 to 2007, he was tasked to prepare the G7-8 World Economic Summits for German Chancellors Gerhard Schroeder and Angela Merkel. As you can imagine, he has many awards and honors. He is a Freeman of the City of London, an honorary PhD from the University of Huntsville in Alabama. He holds a Cross Federal Order of Merit from Germany, Officer of the Legion of Honor, he gained that award from France, Grand Cross Order of Merit from Portugal, and the Order of Bernardo O'Higgins, the highest civilian honor awarded to a non-Chilean citizen. The ambassador and his wife are part-time residents of Hilton Head. They have two grown daughters, one working in London for the UK trying to untangle Brexit, and the other is a veterinarian. I also would like to mention that this program today is sponsored by Wunderbar Together. It's a program between the World Affairs Councils of America and the American Council on Germany. With all of that, I would like you to join me in welcoming Ambassador Amon.
Well, thank you, Margaret. And it's a long time since someone was talking so kindly about me. I'm deeply impressed. And thank you for this kind invitation to Hilton Head World Affairs Council. I must say, you have done this at your own risk, not only because I may sound to you like Henry Kissinger. I'm not making it up. When I was living in D.C., I met Henry quite often, and we used to talk to each other in German, but heavily American-accented German. No, I'm saying you are doing this at your own risk, because maybe you have heard this story about Germans who love long, rambling speeches. But I promised to Lee Wilverding, who is in China right now and who made me come here, that I would restrain myself a little bit and allow time for questions afterwards. So maybe speaking about long rambling speeches, you may have heard the joke about the three ambassadors, an American ambassador, a German ambassador, and a French ambassador, who were caught by a terrorist group and could expect it to be shot. And as customs has it, they all were allowed one last wish. So what were these wishes? So the French ambassador, of course, would ask for a free Michelin star meal. The German ambassador would say, well, I would love to give one long last speech with a respectfully listening audience. And the American ambassador threw up his hands in despair and said, shoot me first. So what I have to say to you will be, of course, my own personal views. And I would start by thanking my friends here at Hilton Head, who I found such wonderful people. My wife and me, we have bought a place here at Hilton Head 7 years ago. And over time, it has become our second home. And since my retirement last year, we try to spend about 3 months a year here at Hilton Head. And we found this place unique, not only because of its nature, but also of the people. There's a strong sense of community here among these people. And these people have quite often an international background. Their experience spans the world. And many of you, I think, have traveled Europe, have been to Germany, and or I may have family relations there. And during my time in Washington, I learned that, by the way, Germans are the largest ethnic group here in America, ahead of the English and the Irish. But many of you, and I want to thank them in particular, are those who have been in Germany for military service. During the Cold War, more than 250,000 American servicemen and women were stationed in my country. And whenever I met them later in America, I only heard happy stories. Some found a spouse in Germany, kids were born in Germany, or at least Hofbräuhaus and the Oktoberfest was a happy memory. So together, we won the Cold War. And next month, as Margaret has just said, it's 30 years that the Berlin Wall came down. Let me begin by taking a look back at how we became where we are today. The fall of the Berlin Wall on November 9th, 1989, stands for the victory in the Cold War, but it also symbolizes the beginning of a new era. The 1990s marked the triumph of globalization, free trade, and it became also a decade of expansion of Western values. Don't forget, former foes, members of the Warsaw Pact countries, became members of NATO. They became members of the European Union. So this was a huge advancement of Western values, Western ideas to the East. At the same time, negotiations with China were launched, and which made this resurgent Middle Empire finally join the WTO in, I think, 2001. It was a time which the American philosopher Francis Fukuyama called the end of history. Capitalism, democracy, free trade were on a winning streak. The attacks of 9/11 in 2001 changed all this. The sights of the collapsing Twin Towers marked the end of a happy period and ushered in a new decade, or an era of seemingly endless wars on terror. These wars were not so much traditional wars as we used to know them, where you had tanks and artillery fighting a well-defined enemy army, and after victory you could all go home and celebrate in a big parade. The war on terror turned out to be much more complex. The most difficult part of it was nation building under the conditions of unconventional warfare. This was a totally new experience for all of us. And this included not only restoring peace and economic development in these failing states, but also the creation and the defense of democratic institutions in these countries. This was an enormous challenge, and if we look back today at the wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, in Mali, and many others, where the West engaged militarily, we find, at least in my view, that we have been successful only half at best. It was not the complete victory which we had hoped to gain. And interestingly, from a German perspective, you know, there's a happy story about the defeated Germany and the defeated Japan after World War II, which turned from dictatorships into poster boys of democracy, and were extremely successful economically after being defeated. This happy story didn't repeat itself in these countries where we went in the early 2000s. Instead, in these countries, we saw the rise of fundamentalism, religious intolerance in vast parts of the world, and the threat of terror became permanent. It's like in the old Greek saga of the Hydra, maybe you remember that. The Hydra was an ugly animal, and when you cut off a head, new heads would grow. Apart from this, the West also had growing internal differences. At the beginning of the Iraq War, you may remember that we had differences of assessment of the of Saddam Hussein's nuclear program, which created a deep split between America on one side and Germany and France on the other side. And then in 2008 came the financial crisis, which added lots of self-doubt about our political and economic system. So clearly, at the end of the first decade of the 2000s, 2010, the position of the West in the world had changed. We found ourselves on a defensive footing. Our strategy, in particular the German strategy, has failed on another front, which is not so much talked about. In the early 2000s, we in Germany had the serious hope that with positive economic development, Russia, post-communist Russia, could become a normal country, and finally, a democratic and market-oriented society, a partner and a potential ally of the West. That was the dream we had. And we, from the German side, invested heavily, money, manpower, to make this dream come true. And if you look at Russia in these years, it came out of a very deep black hole. The situation in Russia in the 1990s was horrible. But in the first decade of the 2000s, Russia grew very fast. So there was hope that this dream could come true. But around 2010, this changed. And one can discuss why. Maybe it was due to high oil prices at the time that Russia decided not to take the hard road to modernize its economy, modernize its society, building democratic institutions. Maybe it was easier to rely on oil income. That's a theory. It opted, or maybe also because of internal struggles, power struggles, to become closer to what I may call a petrostate. Petrostates, you find a number of them in the world, are run by totally different rules. Usually, in a petrostate, the government buys the support of a class of super-rich oligarchs or princes by allowing the proceeds from the sale of its natural resources to go to loyal followers. And from these loyal followers, money trickles down to the general public who become dependent on handouts. Such a system is not compatible with democratic institutions and the rule of law, but it calls for the rule of a strong man, and that's what we see in Russia right now. So, unfortunately, I have to state that around 2010, the first decade of this century, Russia was lost to the West. It has not again become an ideological foe like the old USSR was, with an ideology to preach to us. But it has become an adversary. Russia sees the West as an adversary, always looking for opportunities where we, the West, look weak and undecided. Coming to Europe in this second decade of the 2000s, Europe was, in this whole decade from 2010 to now, in a permanent state of crisis. Europe had grown to a membership of 29 countries with different degrees of economic development and cultural and historic backgrounds. So over time, centrifugal forces started to make consensus finding in a very complicated structure in Brussels more and more difficult. Tensions arose in particular on the question of money to be transferred from the richer parts of the European Union to the poorer parts. And when some spendthrift members in the south of Europe lost access to the financial markets because we were overspending, the North Europeans had to step in and bail them out, which was a very costly enterprise. On top of that, terror visited Europe. You may remember the attacks in Paris, at Bataclan Music Hall, the Christmas market in Berlin, or the the attack on the pop concert in Manchester, just to name a few examples. Then in 2015, almost overnight, a million people arrived in Germany by foot. Migrants from the Syria war, but in their majority, they were migrants from Africa and Asia. This million people who just came to us had to be housed, had to be fed at a considerable cost. Most of them were young males, and many came with unrealistic expectations about the generosity of the German social system, which is fairly generous in international standards. But of course, there were talks, we learned from these young males who came from Asia, from Africa, that everybody would automatically be given a house and could own it. And so these sort of stories were among these people, and we were, of course, disappointed. What we found difficult was that many of these young males had medieval views on women. So this was clearly a source of conflict, of enormous conflict inside my country. In the context, I must say here, quite openly, anti-Semitism, which we had thought to have eradicated in Germany, and of which we were proud, has raised its ugly head again. And we looked at it and discovered some of this anti-Semitism was imported, because many of the Muslim migrants came to us with a strong bias against Israel, but some of the anti-Semitism was also homegrown. So let me assure you that we don't take that lightly. And my government is decided to fight anti-Semitism wherever it shows. And we think this is not something we should talk to. We should not talk to the anti-Semites. We should not have a discussion with the anti-Semites. But it's a matter for the police and to arrest them. Well, like in most other Western countries, our societies became to develop new fault lines. We have an intense discussion on climate change in Germany, and again, people are divided. Is it necessary to change our lifestyle profoundly or not? The split between rich and poor deepened, and the cultural wars of America came to us as well, with deep changes for families and the role of men and women. Political correctness became an issue, stifling free speech at universities and the media. And there was an almost unstoppable trend to overregulation of every aspect of daily life. So I think all this does not sound so very foreign to you. The bad news from Europe is, with the UK now leaving the European Union and populist parties triumphant in the south and east of Europe, this historic project of European unification is at a dangerous juncture. And at this point, we remember that it was the US who masterminded the creation of a European Union, and we are very worried that this support might fade away, seeing us as a competitor only, economic competitor, and looking at us in a zero-sum perspective. Your loss is my gain. So this is a totally different perspective from America, I think, and that is very worrisome. Let me also take a look at the geopolitical situation from a European perspective. When we look to the south from across the Mediterranean, we find it most places show rapidly growing populations in unstable political frameworks. And in many of these countries, there's not much hope of real economic progress. In most of the Islamic societies, modernization is on the retreat. I just ran into an old friend a few days ago who told me that he had traveled in Afghanistan in the 1970s, And at the time, women in Kabul wear miniskirts. Imagine what a change has happened. So modernization is on the retreat. And as the economic prospects for the masses of young people are fading, radical religious ideas become the foundation of governance. So at the eastern rim of the Mediterranean, now we have Turkish strongman Recep Erdogan, who is pandering to his local political support, mostly rural, by rolling back secularism. Turkey has also put out feelers to Muslim Brotherhood organizations, and Erdogan's transactional policies with Russia, Iran, Qatar, as well as the very recent reckless action against the Kurds, endanger the cohesion of NATO. So the old dream of Turkish membership in the EU has gone up in smoke, realistically speaking. To the east of Europe, Vladimir Putin has now been Russia's strongman for 19 years. That's a long time. He once stated that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the biggest catastrophe of the 20th century. I had thought that the 20 million war debt Russia had were the biggest catastrophe, but it shows there's a different perspective. Clearly, his long-term strategy is to roll back the wheel. To this end, he successfully rebuilt and modernized the Russian military with an economy not about the same size as Spain. So the economic base is fairly small, or fairly modest. But he is modernizing the economy very successfully. The army very successfully. He just boasted new types of hyper-velocity cruise missiles, scramjet cruise missiles, and nuclear-driven torpedoes the other day, which are designed to overwhelm any system of missile defense. And very interestingly, at the recent meeting he had, I think two or three days ago, with Recep Erdogan, he mentioned on the sidelines that he was willing to share with China an early nuclear warning system, which would also have a huge impact on the balances of power in the world. He's doing this very considerably. But we should not forget Mr. Putin is riding a tiger. With the economy in stagnation and the oil price no longer at previous heights, he finds it more and more difficult to maintain the public support he needs. In particular, when he wants a smooth transition to a successor who would allow him to retire peacefully. Foreign policy successes recently have boosted his public support temporarily, but we notice that the electorate in Russia is also getting tired of costly military adventures. So Putin needs the narrative of an aggressive West, or the narrative of a terrorist threat from the South, to mobilize public opinion in his favor. So conclusion is we have to play our cards with him very, very carefully. So from a European viewpoint, let me finally look to the West, across the Atlantic to America. For us Germans, America has always been the global rule setter and the defender of a global order with whom we share basic values. Over time, over the decades, we had many squabbles about burden sharing, trade disputes. We had, even if I remember with the Carter administration, we had problems about a pipeline bringing in gas from Russia at the time. So it's nothing that's new about this. And we also had different assessments of the threat occasionally. But this was on the surface. Deep down, there was never any doubt that the US was the world leader and that we are family and that we are in that together. So over the past years now, new fears have arisen in Europe. we notice there's change in America, and the question we ask ourselves, how deep goes the change in America that we feel is happening? When President Kennedy famously claimed global leadership for America in his inauguration speech, he said that America will pay any price, bear any burden, support any friend to assure the survival and the success of liberty. At that time, America represented about half of the world's GDP. Now it's about a quarter. And today, both the German and the US society find themselves divided by a spider web of fault lines, some cultural, some economic, some political in nature. For them, short-term gain seems to trump long-term strategic thinking. And the political debate on both sides turns around dangerous narratives of neglected self-interest on both sides. So if you take all this together and ask yourself, where is that going? One cannot exclude that the world will move from a single dominating country, the US, to a multipolar world where relationships are different. They are transactional and transient. And we have seen such a world before in the 19th century Europe, where realpolitik, as it was called at the time, spawned instability and ultimately war. But I don't believe that we have history to repeat itself. If the US and Europe can stay together, together we now represent about half of the world GDP. And on the military side, of course, the transatlantic community manifests itself in the form of NATO, which remains the most powerful military alliance in the world. But on the economic side, the failure to build a transatlantic free trade and investment partnership, which was called TTIP, you may remember this acronym, was a major strategic blunder. Together, we would have been able to define the rules of the world economy, to set technical standards, and everybody else would have to follow it. Now, after TTIP's demise, China, which is pursuing its long-term plan to take the number one position in the world, has an open playing field. And I believe that the day when TTIP died, the champagne corks were opened in Moscow and in Beijing. This brings me to what I think is the biggest question, or the central question of the 21st century. How will the future relationship between the US and a growing but more and more authoritarian China look like? So already today we have a trade war at hand, which it has huge potential for escalation. And the question I ask myself is this a limited trade war? One to make China play by WTO rules, which we didn't in the past. China clearly was infringed with the rules. They stole patents, intellectual property rights, and they kept their local domestic market closed. So all these things need to change. But is the American government heading for a limited perspective, just to change these deficits, or is it more? And at this point, some people draw historic analogies. There is the ancient Greek historian Thucydides, who wrote that the incumbent power Sparta had felt it had to go to war because Athens at the time was rising. And similarly, historians see the causes of the First World War in the industrial and military rise of Germany at the time, which was about to overtake Great Britain. And it had to be stopped. In both cases, in both historic cases, the empires, all the empires involved, were destroyed. Well, as I said, I think history does not have to repeat itself. And clearly, the Chinese economic and social and political system is vulnerable today. But an all-out economic war between the US and China for supremacy in the world, if that's the objective America is pursuing, could have huge and unforeseeable consequences. In particular, from my perspective, it would open up huge possibilities for countries like Russia, who could opt to become a junior partner of China in this world, in uniting against us. Mr. Putin has proved to be a master of opportunism. Wherever America withdraws, he fills the void. He has just recently shown this in Syria. And yesterday, he was holding a summit with 40 African leaders, probably because he had discovered that Africa is another area which is neglected by the West. He sees an opportunity, and that's why he is putting his foot there. He smells Western neglect and weakness. Where the West is wobbling, Putin finds opportunity. Where the West is clear, like in the Baltic states, which were made members of NATO and the EU, he's holding back, despite the fact that there's a considerable Russian ethnic minority in these Baltic countries. So my first conclusion of all this is trust in each other is the most valuable commodity we have. Trust that the NATO partners are serious about their commitment to each other's loyalty. And again, take a look at the Baltic states. Now there you have American, German, French, British troops stationed in the Baltics acting as tripwires, and everything is quiet. Putin obviously came to the conclusion that we, the West, mean business. So he holds back. And we have seen this pattern before, even in the Cold War. There was trust that the Western resolve to stand its ground in the Cold War has effectively deterred the Soviets from attacking during the Cold War. But as it's often said, it takes a long time to build trust, and it takes only minutes to lose it. So we must strive to preserve this trust. My second conclusion is a very short one. After the end of communism, the world has four new isms to fear. That is fundamentalism, terrorism, Chinese expansionism, and Russian revisionism, and American isolationism. My third and last conclusion will be some very personal thoughts on America. One of the strengths the US has in the world, as I see it, lies in the multitude of alliances it has with other countries. Last time I counted, America had more than 60 military alliances with other countries. Russia and China only have a few client states. You have the dollar as a reserve currency of the world. All this gives America enormous power and influence in world affairs, and I do hope that you will not give that up, because it's quintessential for world peace. Ladies and gentlemen, I could sum up all this very briefly by saying the world of the 21st century will be a very dangerous one. And 30 years since the heady days of German unification, our relationship is at a critical juncture. And as it was said before, the generation whose worldview was shaped by comradeship in arms in an epic struggle of a Cold War, this generation is now slowly fading away. So maybe we have to accept at least gradual retreat of American influence and forces from some parts of the world, given the new distribution of power in the world. But it will be absolutely crucial that this retreat is skillfully handled. And I would like to quote an insight from the Prussian general von Clausewitz, who said, "An orderly retreat is the most challenging military maneuver of all. Of course, isolationists can make the point that America is sitting comfortably between two oceans. But in today's world, geographical distance no longer protects. The 9/11 attacks were originated 8,000 miles away in Afghanistan. Future risks, no matter how far away the rogue actors may be geographically, may come from space, from cyberspace, through social media trolls that endanger our democratic processes, or maybe even through a nuclear bomb smuggled in a suitcase. Because once trust in America is destroyed, nuclear proliferation will get a boost all around the world. Unfortunately, I must say, I cannot see the EU taking the place that America gives up and see the EU as a guardian of the rules-based global system in the foreseeable future. With 29 EU member states now, soon to be 28, we lack the capacity to make the necessary quick and, if necessary, painful decisions. But what we could do, what I hope we will do, is to throw our weights on your side of the scales if America continues to provide leadership. We must have a serious discussion about burden sharing, I accept this, but one that is wider than just on military hardware, because there's more. But what we should not do is put doubt in a transatlantic alliance for which many of you have worked so hard. The media on both sides of the Atlantic are full of commentaries that European-American relations are at an all-time low. I find that unacceptable. The world needs a transatlantic alliance more than ever. It needs American leadership, and I think we should make a fresh effort to widen our alliance to the economic sphere, to stop protectionism, and work together. Thank you very much. Okay, thank you.
Okay, is this microphone live?
Yes, it is.
Okay, it's time for questions and responses. And I'd like to remind you, you're here to hear the speaker's perceptions and the answers to your questions. If you got a question, please ask it. Be as concise as possible so we can get more questions answered. Now, at the beginning, there should be a couple of people who have questions ready to ask, and I think the first one